This episode of The Blotter Presents is brought to you by Rosa, Joanna C., Lucky Dan Casino, Kelly C., Genevieve S., Patrick T., Richard G., and the donor who shall not be named. Thanks so much, you lot. You can join the ranks of Blotter Tipsters at patreon.com/blotterpresents.
Police believe he crisscrossed California while committing his alleged crimes, earning names like the Visalia Ransacker, the East Area Rapist, and the original Night Stalker.
Joseph James D'Angelo has been called a lot of things by law enforcement. Today, it's our pleasure to call him defendant.
In March, Mike Dunn and I talked about Michelle McNamara's I'll Be Gone in the Dark and the adjacent TV special Golden State Killer, It's Not Over. Well, it kind of is now. Authorities took Joseph D'Angelo into custody 6 weeks later, and last Saturday, Oxygen debuted its special Golden State Killer, Main Suspect. Mike is back to discuss it. Later, we'll spend the dog days of August cooling off in the New Yorker archives with a Calvin Trillin crime reader, but first, this meeting of the Carol Daly Appreciation Society's Northeast Chapter is hereby called to order on The Blotter Presents, Episode 63. Is it still a crime if you have to fix it in post? Who can say? Welcome back to The Blotter Presents. I'm the CDAS Recording Secretary, Sarah D. Bunting, and I am joined by Acting Treasurer Mike Dunn. Hi, Mike.
Hello, Sarah.
I believe that you had an additional sponsorship you wanted to mention of this episode.
Oh, we're going to go there? Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this episode is also brought to you by the Boston Red Sox opening a can of whoop-ass on the New York Yankees this weekend. 4-0. Let's put it this way. Paul Holes closed this case very, very quickly and in fine fashion.
Yes, that investigation lasted 4 days and led everyone to conclude that the judge really needs to come back.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Speaking of back, I'm not going to be getting this 90 minutes back. Let's talk about our most wanted. Okay, Golden State Killer, Main Suspect, aired on Oxygen last Saturday. I believe it's available on their website, and they're rerunning it pretty frequently. Here's the case file in case anyone has forgotten. The Golden State Killer is a serial killer, rapist, and burglar who committed at least 12 murders, more than 50 rapes, and over 100 burglaries in California from 1974 to 1986. More on that in a moment. He is believed to be responsible for 3 crime sprees throughout California, each of which spawned a different nickname in the press before it became evident that they were committed by the same person. In the Sacramento area, he was known as the East Area Rapist. Linked to additional attacks in Contra Costa County, Stockton, and Modesto. He was later known for his Southern California crimes as the original Night Stalker. He is suspected to have begun as a burglar, the Visalia Ransacker, what a name, before moving to the Sacramento area based on a similar MO and circumstantial evidence. However, as of June 2018, no direct link had been revealed. That's from the Wikipedia page, and I think the show established a link, but so the show, I don't know, like I feel like dribs and drabs about this case have continued to come out, and Oxygen via their Twitter account released various snippets of, like, you know, that he and his wife slept in separate bedrooms, he escalated when she was expecting a child, that kind of thing, that may have made the special in its entirety not relevant. Mike, did you find this more or less interesting than the other TV property that we covered? Or, like, I just didn't know who this was for exactly.
I think the only interesting aspects about this one, I mean, first of all, let's talk about, you know, this is about an hour and a half in length. And about the first 45 minutes was pretty much a retread of any other thing that we'd seen on the Garden State Killer.
That was an issue.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the same people. I did like that they introduced some new victims that I guess, you know, felt comfortable now to speak about it now that he's been arrested and that he's been put away. So it was good to hear different viewpoints from them. I would say that the things that interested me the most were the people that knew D'Angelo and talking about his weird little intricacies in regards to, like you were mentioning, the fact that, yeah, he's married, but they don't sleep in the same bed. It's like, are they really religious? No, he's just kind of weird.
Yeah.
And certain other things about the one thing you always hear about serial killers is always abuse to animals, and how much this guy hated dogs was brought up by, like, on three different occasions by three different people.
And the I didn't clip this because I just don't enjoy contemplating that, but there were a couple of people in a couple of different communities who were like, yeah, our mom always thought he poisoned the dogs.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, look, dog that won't stop barking is annoying, but maybe I've just lived in a city for so long that it's like, I don't know, move way out in the country then.
Right.
City living is not for you.
Yeah.
What I found interesting, there were a few things that I thought were interesting about this, including I did like that at the end we got to reunite with Paul Holes, T.E. Holes, and of course our girl Carol Daly.
CD.
And watched them get emotional about his capture because they had just been with this case for such a long time.
Yes.
But I was also interested, we heard a little bit about this in the beginning and also at the end, but here's a clip from towards the beginning about whether they even know all the crimes that he committed. Like, they're pretty sure that they have him for like over 200 felonies, but then they're not convinced that they know everything. Here's clip two.
In the years that followed, fear of the Golden State Killer began to subside. But did his crime spree really end?
What do you think the chances are that we're going to hear about potential other crimes in other places that we haven't heard?
I believe there will be other cases that are tied to this. I believe investigators all over California are looking into their cases.
We're not certain that he stopped in May of 1986. He may not have stopped then. He may be responsible for more. So we're seeking to make that determination during the course of the investigation.
It is pretty unusual for a serial offender of this type just to stop. There is a little bit of an explanation for that in a later cue, which we'll get to. I also wanted to play a clip regarding one of the survivors that you mentioned before, and just to call the producers out for what I thought was a pretty tacky choice at the end of this clip. Here's clip three.
He led me out of the house, and he told me to shut up or he would kill me. And that's when I looked in the house and I saw my dad had come through the kitchen. And then I heard just kind of like a loud roar from him. He charged out of the house and the guy pushed me on the ground and shot my dad twice.
I'm actually not certain that we haven't heard from Beth Snelling before, but her father, Claude, died trying to save her. Right after this, we hear that this attempt was not successful and she was assaulted.
Mm-hmm.
But really, with the gunshot noises?
And not just that, to point out that she was only 13 at the time. And them also pointing out, oh, and she hadn't had sex yet. And it's like, oh, great, so you're letting us know that.
Oh, was that her or was that someone else?
That was her
that she lived with. That woman lived with her mom, and her mom was the one who was joking. It was just the two of them, and her mom was like, I'm too old and you're too young.
You might be right. I think I might be getting them confused. Okay.
She, I don't remember her name, Michelle?
This one we listened to was Beth Snelling,
This was
right?
Beth Snelling, but okay. I think the one you're talking about was Michelle.
Margaret Wardlow.
Yes,
That's who it is. I apologize for getting those.
She was a very effective witness, I thought. And they were more... I like that she was almost wry about he comes out with the dishes. And then I knew.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we may have heard from her before, too, because I remember her phrasing that she said, you know, I knew if he went into my mom's room, I was going to get attacked.
Mm-hmm.
And if he came into my room, and then there's a pause and she's like, and he went into my mom's room.
It's hard to keep track at this point because it feels like even just in the last 6 months or even the announcement of McNamara's book coming out, there's been like six or seven of these documentaries that I haven't seen all of them, so I can't keep track in regards to who was on which one.
I haven't either. And the fact is, and we talked about this when we were talking about the book, that any treatment of this case necessarily is going to have a challenge in terms of distinguishing victims and cases from one another. Mm-hmm. And it may be that only the most, not outre, but the most sort of like violent or perverse, or mm-hmm. that he like piled other things besides dishes on them,
right.
that those, it's just hard not to become not lulled, but just lose track
right.
of people, because there were so many people.
Mm-hmm.
It's really insane. And I...
Yeah, like, did he really eat ice cream at every house that he went to?
Yeah.
You know?
And, I mean, rude.
Yeah.
Like, put it back.
Right. That's right. And leaves it out. That's right.
I know. And it's, you know, there was probably DNA all over the place.
Yeah, that's an extra 10 years just for that.
I know, seriously. Like, that's just bad housekeeping.
Yeah,
come
absolutely.
On. But yeah, that's... I have... some sympathy for producers who are faced with trying to get their arms around the sheer size of this case and how many violent crimes were committed,
mm-hmm.
and not have it sort of become a like an emotional drone. But that said, this did not succeed
mm-hmm.
for me, because I'm not sure... I think people who are very familiar with the case and have read the book and watched all the other documentaries are going to kind of be like, and
another one coming on HBO.
Yeah.
Right. They're making one about the book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although, but I mean, that's different. That's scripted, right?
So, yes. Oh, is it scripted?
No, I don't. Actually, I don't think it is scripted, but it's going to be like. It's going to be however long it needs to be, and not like crammed
right.
into this sort of traditional tabloid news mag
mm-hmm.
90-minute box.
Yeah.
But yeah, there was also a lot of Oxygen is okay about this stuff, but sometimes they just sort of default to these tropes of the genre, as in clip four.
Joe was a little odd, a little different. He would talk to himself. He would, go down the, the hall. You can hear him mumbling to himself. So
it sounds like he was just sort of socially awkward, too.
Yeah, I'd say that, yes. He tried, but there was some awkwardness in it.
Better lock me up then.
Yeah.
And my husband and most of the people I know.
Right.
Like, a little awkward, talks mm-hmm. to herself.
Yeah.
She's the Garden State Killer. I mean, just like stuff like that. That and like, a loved one walking along a covered bridge and looking pensive is like, guys, just don't do that for like 10 years.
Yeah.
We've seen it enough times.
Mm-hmm.
We're good. But yeah, it was okay. It was just a little slow
mm-hmm.
and until they sort of got to the end. And then did you feel like they raced through how exactly Paul Holes got to DNA results?
Yeah, they kind of just introduced, DNA started in like 1986 or 1987. Now let's fast forward to Paul Holes saying, and then we did the familial genealogy and we
right.
got a 75% match on some distant relative and
mm-hmm.
then just built out a family tree and bam. And I think they said they cut it down to five
yes.
suspects, right, within that family.
Yeah.
Before eventually narrowing it down to...
And then what was it they used to narrow it down? Because it was someone who had a girlfriend named Bonnie.
It was him. It was
yeah.
D'Angelo that at one of his assaults, he kept repeating over and over again to the woman that he was assaulting, "I hate you, Bonnie. I hate you, Bonnie."
Right.
And then
they found some guy that it came down to that kind of like...
Yeah.
Facebooky sleuthing.
I mean, look, mm-hmm.
I guess I should be more concerned about this as a law enforcement tool than I am. But literally the only reason I even did Ancestry DNA was to see if I was related to the guy who committed the Snowtown murders in Australia. No joy yet, but I mean, look, I think that...
You just haven't gone out far enough yet. You've still
Exactly. So all y'all in Australia... related to Buntings, start sending those kits in because I need to know. Probably. Am I related to the rich, fancy ones who fended Noxzema? No. A guy who stuffed people in barrels? Probably. What did you think of the host of this program? Stephanie Gosk is her name, and she reminds me of someone, and it's driving me freaking crazy.
I thought she was fine. Like I said, there was one scene that I thought was really funny where there was just her on camera and she's walking down a street and she's just talking about the case. And she's looking on from one side of the street to the other side of the street and doesn't make any eye contact with the camera whatsoever. And like, I'm sure if she's realizing you're just the host. You can talk into the camera every once in a while. You're not interviewing someone on either side of the camera. So you can talk to us directly, which as a host, I think you should have done. No, I thought she was fine. I thought she did ask a lot of good questions. Again, a lot of the things that she was asking were things that I'd seen previously in the immense number of other, you know, Garden State Killer last time. the questions she was asking Paul Holes, asked and answered two or three times before.
Yeah.
You know, the questions that she was asking, you know, Detective Shelby and our girl Carol Daly.
Yeah.
Asked
like,
and answered.
Why did you stick
before.
With this case? Like, because that's my goddamn job. I'm a cold case detective.
Right.
I mean,
yeah.
I don't know. I thought that there was some good, I thought there was some good visuals. Nothing great. And they did sort of rely on the one mugshot a lot of times. You will see in our visual aids, which will be on the Twitter and Facebook accounts, which you can follow at Blotter Presents in both places, that, there's the shot of D'Angelo in court in a wheelchair, barely able to summon enough breath to respond with a plea. And Paul Holes is like, yeah, that was bullshit, which was funny.
Yeah.
But they pull to a wide shot and there's like 15 bottles of Purell on the defense table. And I was like, thereby hangs a tale and I'm pretty sure I don't want to know what it is.
Yeah. And then Paul actually asks, after he says bullshit, basically saying why he says bullshit, I was like, yeah, because the last 3 days we saw him doing gardening at his house. He rides his motorcycle like a madman and everything. So when I saw the wheelchair, I was like, oh, what bullshit.
He was running around like yelling at dogs. Like, okay, probably.
Yeah.
As long as he was only yelling at dogs. Mm-hmm. But yeah, here's that second clip I mentioned that was talking about the possibility that he really did just kind of trail off with these crimes. The last one was particularly brutal, and I've read enough John Douglas to know that FBI profilers don't think these guys just stop. They get locked up or die. But here is a few of our commentators, including Dr. Judy Ho, is her name, psychologist.
The Juliana Rancic of Oxygen documentaries.
Oh, is she?
Well, she is to me. She looks like her a lot and sounds like her a lot and seems to have the same bubbly enthusiasm.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what, like, when I first saw her, that was my first thought. But anyway.
Sandy Duncan. That's who Stephanie Gosk reminds me
of. Oh, wow.
It's something about her locutions, like not her accent exactly, but just how she pronounces things. Anyway, here is clip five where they're talking about why he might have just decided to hang up the old breaking in gloves. That's not clip five. Here's clip five.
And with that, the killer receded back into everyday life. But this time, he seemed to stay there. Paul Holes has a theory for why.
Well, some of these offenders, they start to slow down as they get older, and then eventually, I do think they stop.
Oftentimes, for people who are psychopaths, we find that their testosterone tends to be out of proportion to an average male. As they get older, there's still going to be a naturally downward sloping curve, and it's perhaps that he did not have quite the impulses to carry out violence anymore, but that doesn't mean that he wasn't getting those needs met elsewhere.
It's hard to believe that you could go 150 miles an hour down the freeway and then stop suddenly, but I think he just might have.
That last guy was crime writer Michael Bowker, and he had me, and then he lost me. That really is kind of like, so low T is responsible for the end of this reign of terror?
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't really make much sense, but I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, the exception doesn't disprove the rule. I wish we had heard more from Bowker and a little less from some of Joe's friends.
Yeah, where you heard basically saying, oh, yeah, nice guy, but, you know, quiet. Didn't have a really great sense of humor. You kind of heard the same explanations. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was probably like four or five of them that had worked with him, right, at the Save Mart where he was a mechanic, or the ex-police
right.
department officials. That all pretty much said the exact same thing. Yeah, they could have cut out some of those.
Well, and here's one thing I noticed, which was sort of like a cumulative effect, and it's really just occurring to me now, but you have a lot of, you have some like dudes who are like, well, he was a little weird, but one guy right. who was like a neighbor kid who was like, yeah, I learned all of my swear words from that guy yes. when he was yelling at the dogs.
Right.
But mostly like his friends or the people they interviewed who were men were like, yeah, he was a little offbeat, but he was basically fine, generous, fun to go fishing with.
Good father, put his daughters through medical school.
And then the women who were interviewed, remember that cafe owner who called him Mr. Happy?
They were my favorite interviews.
Yeah.
Mr. Happy, yeah. Both of them referring to him as Mr. Happy.
Yeah, the whole staff was like, I'm glad he's locked up. Fuck him.
Yeah.
He was probably a terrible tipper,
yeah.
too.
Yeah, don't Amazing. You ever fucking pinch me there again.
Yeah.
The one woman.
I can't believe that.
Yeah, and she said, like, that actually startled him. Like,
yeah.
He was, like taken aback and was like,
was
oh.
that the same lady who said that they were just having, like, some small talk about how her pants were loose and she needed a belt?
She needed a belt, yes.
He brings her a belt, like, wrapped up in a nice little box the next day and says you can wear it around your waist or around your neck.
Or around your neck, yeah.
Whichever, and it's like... Okay, you yeah. know what? Find another diner to go to, creepo.
Yeah.
But, ugh, I don't know. But again, that's not something that I would be like, you're creepy, but I wouldn't even conclude anything from
right.
it, because it's just some old guy who's being inappropriate.
Yeah. Yeah, he could just
Must be Wednesday.
He could just be three decades out of date.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. And... Or like, thinks that's what the kids are joking about these days? Like,
right.
no, grandpa.
Shocking he's not woke. You know? So.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is definitely something that there's like a theme about, like, that he just kind of thinks that he's smarter than other people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a theme that we're going to see in the cold case section, actually, in some of the crimes that I'll be talking about that were covered by Calvin Trillin. But our last clip from this is pretty telling as to, like, he, you know, occasionally he moves, not venues, but he'll move to another part of the state. But at no time did it seem to occur to him to, like, change his name, move away. And I think after enough time had passed, he was just like, I got this.
Yeah.
Here's clip six.
There's no indication that in recent years he was concerned at all of living in this area where you were investigating at the time, where law enforcement was still looking into the East Area Rapist.
He's absolutely comfortable and he's confident that we weren't close. I can guarantee he's following his case in the media. He's trying to figure out exactly what's going on. But he still was comfortable enough to carry out his normal living activities. So whatever he was seeing wasn't scaring him to where he thought he had to run and actually get out of the state or get out of the country.
That's really something, I think, because if I were him, a lot of things would be different and fucked up. But if I were him, I'd be like, all right, I'd be confident to a certain point. That point being, I'm going to say the OJ trial, that it's like, they're never going to get me.
Mm-hmm.
But once DNA starts being a standard part of criminal investigation and criminal litigation, that it's like, I just find somewhere where there's no extradition and go there pronto. Like, I raised my kids and I'm just going to go.
Yeah.
I mean... Does that seem... I guess it's impossible for us to really understand how guys like this think about in any way, but especially with something like that, I'd be like, I can't even get away with not paying a parking ticket, so I'd just be like, okay, I'm going to Costa Rica. Like,
yeah, and I think he's probably been so far removed from working as a police officer in, what, Exeter, I believe it was, right?
That, yeah.
Like, would it surprise you if this guy never even had a computer? you know, or like had any access to social media or anything like that. Because he had been spending his later years as a car mechanic, I think they said, or working at the Save Mart distribution center.
Yeah.
Where you wonder just how out of touch he might be with what's going on. Like, he may not even know what DNA is all about at this point. You know, he may not even be reading into it that much.
Yeah, that's true. I think he had been off the force for a while. And in any case, they said he was not, I mean, he was just like a kind of a beat cop guy, right?
Yeah.
Like, just patrol and wasn't exceptional in one direction or the other.
Yeah. Although there was the one police chief that he worked for that said, we all thought he was too smart for us and should be working in the FBI.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was interesting. Mm-hmm. His one police chief from Exeter. I found that interesting because just from what we've seen of our physical view of what he is now, it's like, I don't see FBI agent in this person even previously.
Well,
you know,
at
all.
I could see him being that sort of, I don't know, uses big words kind of guy.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, well, you're too smart to be here. That it's like, well, all right. That's a sad statement about policing.
Yeah.
That it's like, well, you're too smart to be here. Go work for the feds. Like, no, you should stay here. As it turns out, he was too smart. Almost.
Almost.
But not quite.
He almost got away with it.
I would say this is not an unpleasant hour and a half, like, except for that tacky gunfire thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's fine. It's well made. Stephanie Gosk, I think, is a good, like, conduit for all this information. The framing device where she's like, I'm just going to retrace his footsteps through the 60s and 70s and up to the present day. It's a little much. But it's, I mean, it's fine. It's competently packaged. Mm-hmm. It's not too trashy. Like, it's fine. But if you have been following this case and, like, you know, have like Google alerts about it or anything like that, it's not for you. You're not going to find anything new. And you can just go to the Oxygen page and look at some of the snippets of the interesting parts of it. I mean, I guess the part where, like, they had separate bedrooms, maybe in the 70s that was more of a scandal, but, like,
right. Yeah,
I don't know.
It's not that long after the 50s and 60s television when everyone slept in separate beds,
Also, I don't know, like, my husband and I both snore. Only one of us can sleep through it, and it's not me, and we don't have air conditioning in the master bedroom, so I haven't seen my husband when it's dark out in like 2 months. It's not determinative, but I can't really recommend it, but it's fine.
Yeah,
it's fine if you're very interested in the case, or if you want kind of a one-stop shop that gets it done in an hour and a half, 2 hours, this is fine.
Yeah, if you have not seen any of the plethora of other ones that have been made, or you don't want to wait for the one that's being made by HBO, I mean, okay, it's a good place to start. You know, for people that have sat through the other documentaries before, you know, it's going to have a lot of your hot buttons. You know, all of you hashtag hot for Halls people. This is another Paul Halls display. He's probably the most prominent person outside of Stephanie Gosk.
Yeah,
I would say.
I think so.
You know, you have your good share of our badass favorite, Carol Daly, that's presented here, and Richard Shelby. So some of the other favorites are back and interviewed here. I think for me, like I said, what I took away from it was actually getting to listen to some of the other victims and listening to what some of the friends said. I'm still struck by the one guy, Richard Mangang, which I love that name, by the way. Richard Mangang.
Dick Mangang.
Dick Mangang. I think he was the last person that Stephanie closed the documentary with, basically saying, so what do you think? And he's like, well, I talked to his daughters, and we all just want to believe that this isn't true because, you know, DNA has been wrong before.
Oh, yeah, that was unfortunate.
Yeah, and I was like, has it?
I know. Is it, though?
Yeah, I need to Google search that one. When has DNA been wrong in one of these cases?
Yeah, I really don't think so. I mean, maybe the way in which they got it. Like, I can't imagine that any court is not going to do everything in its power to keep that evidence chain in.
And yeah, it's probably more of a privacy aspect in regards to how it was, like you're saying, how it was obtained versus anything else.
I think that's probably going to be on the DNA companies to tighten up their access to mm-hmm. people who might only be like fourth or fifth
right.
cousins. But I am not an attorney, and I don't, I'm not an expert in terms and conditions, authorship. So listeners,
I'm not going to be one either. Right?
Yeah, no, so. that's not going to happen. I'm too busy editing podcasts. So no. Listeners, if you, can correct us on that point, please do.
Oh, wait, can we talk about one other thing?
Sure.
Before we go? Some of the sketch artists did a really good job. Some of them did not. But there was one baby. There was one where the guy's face was so thin and gave him a mustache and gave him the perfect 70s haircut, where I think I mentioned last time that, you know, we could be talking about any cast member of Dazed and Confused or Everybody Wants mm-hmm. Some. He looked exactly like the one guy from Everybody Wants Some whose name I cannot remember right now. All you Linklater fans all you Linklater fans probably know exactly who I'm talking about. But there was the one baby face picture that was sketched that I had not seen before in any of the other ones, where I thought, oh my God, if this was 20 years earlier, Andy Richter would be playing Joseph D'Angelo in this movie.
Oh, yeah.
Oh my goodness. Like
I'm not sure if I got that in the visual aids, but I'll try to clip a pic. There's one where I think that one, Paul Holes and Stephanie Gosk are standing in his like war mm-hmm. room.
Yes.
And I think it's on an easel behind him. So mm-hmm.
yeah, and they do a slow pan down, and there's that little sketch mm-hmm. of this and he did look so young, like he was almost like in high school.
Yeah.
It was such a It was so baby-faced. Yeah, but I saw creepy. That and I'm like, that is a cross between the Gerber baby and Andy Richter. So
sorry, Andy Richter.
Yeah, we love you, Andy.
And
we
also do. Gerber babies from time immemorial. Mike, where That's else all. Can people find you and your thoughts and feelings on true crime and everything else?
Pretty much at Twitter, at Mikey okay. WM Free. You know, my music blog is, you know, 28 years in the making and, and still to be started up, so...
So, one day.
And when it does, you'll see the announcement at Mikey WM Free on Twitter.
Indeed. Thanks for coming back in.
Thanks
see
for having
you when
me.
The HBO documentary comes out.
Get ready, Patton. We're coming for you.
So today I'd like to share with you a 4-pack by Calvin Trillin from the pages of The New Yorker. I don't think Trillin is best known for his true crime writing, but... said true crime writing is everything that it inspired me to start the blotter just as a blog years ago. What I'm trying to do on this podcast and on the, you know, blotter.com in general is to review the writing and construction and relative success of the narratives of true crime, and also... When I started the blotter, this was more of a thing, and then Serial came along, but basically trying to, like, reclaim it from the ash heap of cultural esteem. Now that we've had The Staircase and The Jinx and Making a Murderer and, you know, now true crime is it. But when I started the blog, it was not. And Trillin and his book Killings, which is also excellent, and which I have reviewed... On the blog, you'll find that in the show notes, along with links to all of the pieces that I'm about to talk about. But Trillin would have been exhibit, if not A, then pretty high up in the alphabet, as to what well-written nonfiction crime writing could really do. I'm also struck by the relevance that all of the stories I selected, the first three are from about 10 years ago. And then the last one is from the mid-70s. I'm struck by how much relevance each one has today to things that we're still talking about. So let's begin. The first piece is called Incident in Dodge City from the May 10, 2010 issue of The New Yorker. The crime. After, he said, Tanner Brunson and Steve Holt almost hit him in their four-wheeler, Sam Bonilla gave Brunson and Holt the finger. Brunson and Holt stopped the truck and got out to confront Bonilla. Bonilla shot them both and killed Holt. Sentenced to 6 years for voluntary manslaughter and aggravated battery, Bonilla claimed that the shootings were self-defense. Bonilla was also, not for nothing, a Mexican immigrant who had lived in Dodge City legally for 20 years.
Holt and Brunson, per Calvin Trillin, were what Brunson would have described as, quote, good old country boys. The story. This is a little more rushed and dry than Trillin's customary crime output. Incident in Dodge City is still a bracing read, though, in no small part because the simmering racial tensions surrounding a crime committed by a, quote, non-citizen that the article depicts remain a relevant topic in these Build That Wall days. The attack on, or by, or both, Brunson and Holt led not just to a debate about whether a Latinx man could get a fair trial in this part of Kansas, but other debates. One about journalistic shield laws, after Claire O'Brien's jailhouse interview with Bonilla ran her afoul of local prosecutors, and concealed weapons statutes in Kansas, which pro-gun advocates felt then were too restrictive, and basically didn't allow gun owners enough latitude to shoot at people they felt annoyed by. Don't bother owning this lib for that oversimplification, please. Thank you. And both of these conversations feel very of the moment as well, in a post-Parkland world in which the president is more or less bountying the traditional news media. In a case that sends so many tendrils into so many different capital I issues, an overviewing author is wise to stay mostly out of its way, and Trillin mostly does. The Trillinist section, in classic Trillin-y fashion, renders 40 years of a double album of country songs of a working life with just a few brushstrokes. And now, voice actor Dan Patrick Brady shares with us the Trillinist section.
Born in Mexico, he moved to Southern California, where an older sister was living, when he was 13, and he became a legal U.S. resident. His English is fluent. He might be taken for Italian rather than Mexican. He says he does have some Italian ancestry. He worked in a meatpacking plant for only a year or so. Then he worked as a welder. Then he opened a juice bar and a health food store. In 1995, he started teaching martial arts. About 10 years ago, he went to work for Cox.
Bonilla, Trillin mentions elsewhere, also worked as a bail bonds investigator slash tracker on occasion, and I am interested to know how one reconciles that, welding and juicing, on one's CV. Once again, that is Incident in Dodge City. At the train bridge. This is from the July 2709 issue of the magazine, and I believe this is the piece that was circulating a bit on Twitter last week and which inspired me to dig into the Trillin oeuvre in The New Yorker. The crime. Scott Johnson was hiding in the woods by a Menominee River swimming hole, contemplating his options after having sexually assaulted a friend the evening prior. Quote, he has said that because he didn't consider the young woman nearly as attractive as some of the women he'd known when he had a job and money, he became enraged when she rejected his advance. End quote. Wearing camouflage from head to toe and in possession of a small arsenal, Johnson, already wanted in two other states for hanging paper and failure to pay child support, decided to go out with a bang and murdered three of the teenagers hanging out at the train bridge swimming hole. Johnson, who will be in prison for the rest of his life, has told the Detroit News in recent years that he feels no remorse and likely never will. The story. Trillin's account of this particular random lightning strike of toxic masculinity is stereotypical Trillin in its tightly controlled contempt for Johnson, the gentleness of his phrasing making his opinion of Johnson stronger rather than fainter. Quote, according to one psychologist, Johnson's stories in general tended to involve, quote, the ways in which he has been mistreated by others and about his own superior assets and virtues, end quote. And Johnson's consistent and clueless blaming of others for his various troubles is a recurring theme. There is a short section in which it seems like the piece might expand into the territory of sentencing. Victims' families did try to have Johnson sentenced as a terrorist, as the train bridge is, or was at one time, technically federal land. But primarily, this is a bloody snapshot of incel carnage abetted by lax weapons possession statutes. Here is the triliniest section, Dan.
At 38, a healthy and fit and presentable 38, he was living with his mother in Kingsford, Michigan, having retreated in 2001 from an increasingly unsuccessful decade in Louisiana.
Trillin at times can seem like a patronizing city mouse with these understated characterizations, but they're usually devastating regardless. And in this case, Johnson has earned the semi-snotty verbal eyebrow flick of increasingly unsuccessful decade, and then some. Our third piece is called The House Across the Way and comes from the June 25, 2007 issue of The New Yorker, The Crime. And before I begin, I reached out to past guests, Alex Collins and Danny McEachran, to make sure I was pronouncing this municipality correctly. I'm still not 100 that we got it right, but here we go, blundering ahead. The residents of Grand Manan were already fed up with alleged drug dealer Ronnie Ross before his friend Jimmy Irvine, maybe allegedly, started stealing their shit and fencing it on the mainland. The small, self-isolating New Brunswick community of mostly fisher people mostly wanted him gone. And when Ross and Irvine started, allegedly, threatening neighbors with firebombings, matters descended into flare gun violence and a vigilante arson. The locals literally joined hands to prevent local firefighters from fighting. The story. Per Trillin's piece, quote, one resident of Cedar Street told the RCMP that despite all the talk of drug problems, the eruption of violence was essentially part of a personal war between Ross and his neighbors. Another way of saying that what really got Ronnie Ross put off Grand Manan was what Laura Buckley called his, quote, asshole issues. Trillin also refers to Grand Manan's status as basically creating lab conditions for drug problems. 3 hours from the nearest city, unwelcoming to outsiders, reliant on an industry that's not only backbreaking but hardly recession-proof and not for nothing, whose broken backs would likely be treated with opiates, so one does wonder how the island is faring on that front a decade later. The house across the street is about the central melee, but also about the policing challenges faced, and sort of created, by, quote, cut-off communities like Grand Manan, or Broad Channel here in New York City. In a larger sense, though, it's about how a community emotionally criminalizes that one noisy shithead near the end of the block, the figurative outsider who won't fall in line with local norms and also won't leave. There is a book about the noisy shithead writ large. It's called In Broad Daylight by Harry McLean. I own it, but I have not read it. And if you have read it, I would love to hear from you in the comments. Here's the trillinery from this piece.
Accounts of what happened when the trouble started are imprecise. It was dark. People on both sides of Cedar Street had been drinking. It's clear that the sides were not evenly matched. There were fewer than a dozen people at Ross's, and were not cleanly divided between outsiders and islanders. Some of the people at Ross's house were from Grand Manan, and a few of the people at Carter Foster's side of the street may at times have tempered their outrage at drug dealers with a few purchases of their own.
The precision of the word imprecise is everything I love about Trillin, who elsewhere describes Grand Manoner's tolerance for softer drugs, quote, wavering when it comes to cocaine and running out pretty much entirely at crack. And for our final piece, we'll return to the June 2nd, 1975 issue of The New Yorker. This one you will probably need a subscription to access in their archives, as it's just a scan. But I recommend, if you don't have a subscription, borrowing someone's login just so you can see the old ads. There was not one for the poke boat, but I'm sure it was lurking somewhere. Because isn't it always? This piece is called Causes and Circumstances. The Crime. This is taken from Christopher Bailey's memoir. Bailey was a former prosecutor in Seattle. SPD officer Alan Earlywine and his partner heard about a Woodinville robbery committed by five black men. They staked out the Mercer Island Bridge, a logical place to intercept Woodinville robbers returning to Seattle. The officers recognized a car from a previous robbery, signaled it to pull over, and ordered the driver, Joseph Hebert, to get out. Hebert got out, ran, and was shot. The shooting was widely publicized, and the inquest results were widely anticipated. Unfortunately, as in the Elmore case, the results were confusing. Earlywine testified he fired in self-defense after Hebert wheeled on him, holding what Earlywine thought was a gun but which proved to be a knife. Hebert's family attorney tried to show the story was a lie. The inquest jury, which included two black jurors and was conducted by a black judge, found by a 5-1 vote the homicide was not justifiable, but by a 4-2 vote they also found the officer had been in reasonable fear for his life. The story. Bailey's version of these events differs little from Trillin's. 2018's version of these events differs little from 1975's. Trillin more or less declines to investigate whether, as Seattle PD's defenders at the time had it, Joe Hebert's criminal record justified his death, focusing on whether the color of his skin caused his death. And now for the Trillinology. Remember the ironic understatement I mentioned before? It said it's most effective in this piece from the Ford administration. It's difficult to pick a single bone-dry observation here. Trillin doesn't take long in his first graph to note that a Terry stop is what civil libertarians call a stop and frisk and what black people call, quote, petty harassment. And he moves quickly on to note that Seattle was said to be, at this time, a city that, quote, still had a chance, which is partly, of course, a way of saying that it does not have an unmanageable number of poor black people. End quote. And I'm pretty confident that that's all that's saying. But his trademark sardonic understatement is at its most stiletto-esque with this. Dan?
Black people do not need arguments based on bullet trajectory or statistics about the percentage of blacks among people shot by policemen to feel that a white policeman confronted by a black man may leave a few of the alternatives to shooting unexplored.
This archness could feel superior, stuck up, the clubby man of letters delivering an opinion on the hoi polloi. Trillin's food writing has more often felt like that to me, a bit self-congratulatory about visiting the same food trucks as, quote, real people. But when he's writing about crime, about killings, that ironic anthropological remove is just the thing, and is perhaps the only thing that lets him or his readers not lose hope. Next time on The Blotter Presents, Alex Collins joins us for another double shot of podcasts. Slow Burn is back for a new season about William Clinton's high crimes and misdemeanors, and we'll talk also about a notorious kidnappee, or was she, that he pardoned on his way out of office, Patty Hearst, as we look at CNN's podcast, Patty's Got a Gun. Got a tip for The Blotter Presents? Find me on social media. That's at Blotter Presents on both Facebook and Twitter. You can email me at bunting@the-blotter.com, and you can become an official Blotter tipster at my Patreon page, patreon.com/blotterpresents. My guest has been Mike Dunn. He is on Twitter at MikeyWMFree. Today's voice acting duties were taken on by my husband, Dan Patrick Brady. He's on Twitter at Dan Patrick Brady. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.